Welcome to Context, a podcast about the history behind current events in the Middle East. I'm Becky Nyman. This week's episode, Purim. Every year, the same old story. If nothing else, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has a flair for the dramatic. Nothing drives the story of Purim home like an existential conflict with Iran. So with the current political diplomatic crisis in mind, let's take a deeper look at the Purim story in historical context and see how it resembles and how it differs from the current standoff of the Jews versus Iran, aka Persia. Megillat Esther tells the story of a close call for the Jews when a great threat posed by the evil minister Haman was thwarted by the beautiful Queen Esther and her uncle Mordechai. The Purim story describes what would become a template for future cycles of anti-Jewish hatred. In the first part of the cycle, a nation or an empire experiences a loss of power and prestige and turns to the Jews as a source of blame. The elimination of the Jews and the acquisition of their wealth becomes the solution to the problems at hand. In the following audio segment, Dr. David Nyman gives a dramatic account of the Battle of Thermopylae. It is at this battle that the Persian Empire was defeated by the up-and-coming Greeks. This loss created a fertile environment for the events that would later occur in Megillat Esther.
All right, now what is peculiar about the Megillah of Esther? The peculiarity is that they write the story as if it were just what we read there. Namely, one guy, Haman, gets it into his head to destroy the Jewish people. He promises the king that if he lets him do it, he's going to enrich the treasury. And then, of course, we have the conflict and the resolution, and that's the story. So it's a kind of nice story. I believe that this Megillah was written after 450, that is, after 450, before the Common Era. At that time, 450, we also know from the books of Ezra and Nehemiah that the Jews were in favor with the Persian emperors. So when they wrote this story, they were writing about something that may have happened some time ago, but it turned out all right, and everything's all right now. So they overlook the details of what it was that led to this thing. Now let's get to what I call the real historical background. When we read the history of Herodotus, we read about two major wars. And this was the point of his history. He was writing the history of the Greco-Persian wars. They took place in 490 before the beginning of the Common Era and in 480 before the beginning of the Common Era. During the first Greco-Persian war, the emperor was Darius, Dariavish in the Bible, Dariavish in Persian, written as Darius or Darius in English or French. During the second war, Xerxes is the emperor of Persia, and his name is Ahasuerus. So Ahasuerus was the emperor during the second war. Now, when we read the accounts of the wars, it's interesting. The Persian Empire extended, as we read from the Book of Esther, and as we read from all the Greek historians, over all of Western Asia, from India to Africa, to Ethiopia, from the Black Sea down to Arabia. And when the Persian emperors mobilized their armored forces, they had contingents or armies from every one of the nations in their empire. Herodotus describes them, and he goes into detail. So they had a massive armored force. The Greeks were smaller in number and might have been overwhelmed and defeated by the Persians, except for certain things that took place, which we will go into. I want to mention something else and to clarify something. Where the Megillah of Esther says 127 Medinot, and I explained that Medinot in Hebrew means states, but it doesn't mean that in the Megillah, because we know that the gubernatorial districts were only about 30. But the word Medina, and it says the Jews lived in all 127 Medinot of the empire. Medina in the Megillah means what I call urban centers. And as we know, Jews tended to gather into urban centers, to live in cities or around cities. We know that the Jews were involved in many areas in Babylonia and agriculture as well. But generally, the Jews tended to live in cities. And so there were 127 urban centers in the Persian Empire where Jews lived. And these are the 127 Medinot, which they mention, which I translate as urban centers. Now, in the first war, when Dariavash came with his great army, the Greeks somehow, in a battle, a very significant battle, managed to drive off the Persian invasion. And that was the Battle of Marathon. And so at the Battle of Marathon, the Greeks won a victory, which blocked the Persian advance and sent them back across to Asia. You know the story of Pheidippides, who ran from Marathon to Athens in order to inform the Athenians that the Greeks had won. And well, he hadn't gone into training, and he hadn't gone into carbo loading and all of that. So he ran from Marathon to Athens. When he got there, he dropped dead, but he gave them the news. We won. We drove them out. The Persians had already conquered certain areas of Europe north of Greece, so they were already in that region. But they were driven back at the first war under Darius at the Battle of Marathon. Remember, the Persians launched an invasion, and they didn't win. They were defeated. That means something. The second invasion, Xerxes, launches this invasion, and I have to read you some parts of it, because Herodotus describes the armies of Xerxes, and it's amazing how great these armies were. He describes the peoples who were involved in it. He says the Assyrians went to war with brass helmets. They carried shields, lances, and daggers. But in addition, they had wooden clubs, which were knotted with iron. In other words, maces, that is, clubs with spikes in them. They had linen skirts. The Assyrians and the Chaldeans served in their ranks. The Bactrians, these are people from Afghanistan, went to war wearing a headdress very like the Medes, but they were armed with bows and arrows. The Scythians were clad in trousers and wore tall, stiff caps rising to a point. They bore the bow of their country and the dagger. They carried the battle axe. The Indians from India wore cotton dresses and carried bows of cane and arrows of cane with iron at the points. Such was the equipment of the Indians. The Aryans, and these would be people from Persia and northern India, carried medium bows. The Parthians and Khwarazmians and Sogdians and Gandharians and all of these others came with their armors. The Caspians were clad in cloaks of skin. The Sarangians had dyed garments. The Pactians wore cloaks of skin. The Arabians wore a long cloak fastened about them with a belt and carried long bows. The Ethiopians were clothed in skins of leopards and lions and had long bows made of the stem of the palm leaf. On these they laid short arrows made of reed and armed at the tip, not with iron but with a piece of stone sharpened to a point. So, he is describing the armies of the Persian Empire, which were many armies of many nations. The eastern Ethiopians, and here he talks about the differences, which the Greeks called Ethiopians, were the dark-skinned people of Africa as well as the dark-skinned people of India. He says the eastern Ethiopians were marshaled with the Indians. They differed in nothing from the other Ethiopians except their language was different and their hair was different. The eastern Ethiopians have straight and curly hair, while the Libyans are woolly-haired. So you see, he gives a description of the two different types, and he talks about all of these armies, which, and he goes on and on. Xerxes' armor and Xerxes' armed forces that came to defeat Greece and to conquer Greece, this was one of the most massive armies in all of history, one of the great military operations. The Persians had a fleet. The fleet of the Persians were actually Phoenicians. Phoenicians were the great sailors of the ancient world. And when the Persian Empire was established and Phoenicia became a part of the Persian Empire, the Persians depended on the Phoenicians for their naval power. So the Phoenicians were running the navy of the Persian Empire, and they were the master mariners. Now, Xerxes comes at the head of his army. And this is this massive army coming from Asia and from Africa to attack and to conquer Greece. And they made inroads, and the Greeks are really outnumbered. But the battle is supposed to begin. Now, what he describes is that Xerxes had a throne made, which was he carried with him. He had it put on a rock overlooking the sea, where a great naval battle was going to take place. And the Phoenician fleet, that is the Persian fleet, was a massive fleet, large numbers of ships. He gives numbers. And the Greek fleet was of smaller ships and smaller in number. Well, it seemed, I suppose, any military analyst would have predicted, well, of course the Persians are going to smash the Greeks. But then something happened. And one of the Greek commanders realized that they were in a certain position where they could have an advantage. And so the Greek navy kind of backed into a narrow area, and the Persians were massing against them. But when they got into this place, the Greeks were an advantage because they had a narrow area and the Persian fleet couldn't get in there. So the Greeks started to attack the Persian fleet, and before they knew it, the Persian fleet was being overwhelmed. He says that Xerxes was seated on his throne, and he sees his fleet being defeated by the Greeks, and he starts to tremble in shock, and it's a tremendous, incredible defeat. The battle was at a place called Salamis, and it was the Battle of Salamis, at which the Greeks defeated the Persian fleet. There was also a place called Thermopylae, which means the hot springs. And Thermopylae was also a place where somehow 300 Greeks could get into a narrow place, and as the Persians were just streaming in on them, they were in a position of command. And so Leonidas, the Spartan, and his men at Thermopylae were able to beat off the Persians as they came in. So here was this great Persian army, as large as you can imagine, the largest army in history, and it's being defeated by this small contingent of Greeks, both in the water as well as on the land. So Xerxes had to retreat and go back to Persia with loss. Now let me tell you something, which you all know. When you go to war, you're going to spend a lot of money. And when you go to war, you're going to have a lot of men and a lot of wealth poured into that battle. And if your campaign is victorious, well, then you can celebrate and enjoy the fruits of your victory because you're going to get a lot more than you invested. But suppose you invest in a tremendous campaign with all of these armies and all of this equipment and all of these men and all of these ships, and you are defeated, then you have suffered a great loss, not only of your men and your ships, but all the money that you poured into it is gone down the drain. You've been defeated. And you know what's interesting? Even after these defeats, of course the Persian Empire continued to exist. It was a vast empire, 4 million square miles, so they didn't conquer Greece. They still continued, but the loss, the immediate loss, was a tremendous loss. Now let's get back to this book of Esther. And Haman comes up to the king with a plan. And his plan is, you know, there are these Jews in the empire. They live all over the empire. They're different. A lot is different about the Jews. Not only that, you look at the Jews, they seem to be prosperous. You know what would be a good idea, Your Imperial Majesty? If we decide to attack the Jews and get rid of them and confiscate all of their money and their property, I can pour that into the royal treasury. So he says, you give me permission to destroy the Jews, and I will give you 10,000 talents of silver for your treasury, meaning I'm going to replenish what you lost and enrich your treasury with all the money that we will confiscate from the Jews, and then we'll get rid of them. This happened in Persia shortly after 480 before the Common Era, let's say after the war, 470, between 480 and 470. But the pattern is interesting, that the pattern has been repeated throughout the history of the Jewish people living under foreign domination. Confiscate Jewish money and property, get rid of the Jews, and we've solved the problem. And here it is in the book of Esther, in a passage which is just two verses, which is often overlooked, namely, what he was planning to do. And so we have a very interesting setting for the book of Esther. The only problem with the Megillah is that I believe it was written a good 30 years after these wars. The people didn't remember all the details. They didn't remember how this thing worked out in terms of what the plans were. What they remembered was that the Jews were saved, and they were saved because a Jewish girl or a Jewish woman had become the emperor's favorite, and she intervened. And this may be a factor. It may also be a fact that the policies had changed, that at a certain point the emperor was convinced maybe we should annihilate the Jews and confiscate their property and all their money. And then later on he may have said, well, wait a minute. The Jews are a valuable asset to the empire. Make no sense to get rid of the Jews. And we don't know exactly at what point this had changed. But it seems to me that following the Greco-Persian War, when Xerxes massed this tremendous army and invested all of that and was defeated, that he was in deep trouble financially, and then Haman tried to come up with a solution to the problem by attacking the Jews and confiscating their property. What Haman says about the Jews is typical and similar to what has been said about the Jews in later ages as well. It's as if he made the statement, and then it's repeated again and again and again throughout Jewish history, throughout Christian history, throughout Muslim history. Why would the king have listened to such a proposition, to such a proposal? He was in trouble, and here was someone who was coming up with a possible solution to his problem. As far as confiscating Jewish property and getting rid of the Jews, well, maybe it's not a nice thing to do, but well, why not? It's a practical thing. We can do it. Many kings and rulers have advisors with differences of opinion, and I'm certain that there are some who were saying one thing and siding with Haman and some who were opposed to him. So there was not unanimity. In other words, according to the story of Esther, when the king realized she was Jewish, then he decided, well, he's not going to destroy the Jewish people because he's not going to destroy Esther. But that's a personal note. I would think that the policy was changed by other considerations which were suggested. Today, in our situation, there are some who are in favor of what the president wants and some who are opposed, and the opposition is rather large in terms of numbers. So you always have this. Even on the question of whether the Jews are more valuable as a peaceful component of the empire, or perhaps valuable at this moment because we can simply confiscate their property and get rid of them, that's something which is subject to debate. The Talmud says that Ahasuerus was stupid. Why? Because every suggestion that he made to him, he says, okay, you want this, okay, you want this, okay. It's as if he simply accepted whatever latest proposition was laid before him. You know, Herodotus also says, there's something dumb about Xerxes, the way he ran his thing. So there's really no opposition between the evaluation, let us say, the personality of Xerxes from the Greek point of view as from the Jewish point of view. They seem to agree that the man was man and not a man of decision, and not a man who could make up his mind without being swayed one way or another. At a certain moment, he was swayed by Haman, and later on, whether it was just Esther's intervention or simply a realization, this is crazy, you know, crazy, we can't do a thing like that, the thing changed. But we have Esther's version of it, and then we have the outside historians who give us more of the information that we need. And so we have what I believe is the true historical background of the Book of Esther. And that's why I believe it's a historical account. It doesn't tell us the history, because it tells us in the story in story form, in the form of this event that took place, which, of course, we recognize and accept as a happy ending story for the Jews. But we cannot detach it from the reality of the history. In other words, we have to read the history of Herodotus, the history of the Persian Wars, and then we can see the Book of Esther in its proper setting. You know, Megillah, in Yiddish, when we say the ganze Megillah, the whole story, and it's been adopted in the American language, a lot of Americans use the word, meaning the whole story, the whole Megillah. I think you understand the story of Purim and Esther a little better than before. The Megillah of Esther doesn't give us the whole story.
That was Dr. David Nyman on the historical background to Purim. Clearly, the relationship of the Jews to the Persian and now Iranian people have had their ups and downs. However, we were not always enemies, and we don't have to be enemies in the future. It's my hope that the more moderate and reasonable forces in Iran will gain influence, and then we can look back to another great Persian, Cyrus the Great, who worked with the Jews to rebuild and support the land of Israel. Thank you for listening to Context, the podcast. You can follow the Context blog on the Times of Israel website, join the Dr. David Nyman Google Plus circle, and follow Dr. David Nyman on Twitter. And please visit drdavidnyman.com for more audio, video, and other fascinating information.